started. My name is Doug Thorpe. I teach Seattle Pacific University. I'm saying this for the media people who are taping the session. And this is our fourth session on Leslie Silko's novel Ceremony, although I was going to for a moment say, well, let's talk about Romans 8. And everybody get naked.
Yeah, I did that already.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. Good. I don't have to do that. And there are more copies of the handout on their way. A couple of faithful assistants. I'm going to start with an excerpt or two from a collection of essays by Leslie Silko called Yellow Woman and a Beauty of the Spirit. And Yellow Woman is in reference to a mythological figure named Kochi Nanako, it's one of her names, who, again, is representative of, as in yellow, sort of corn woman associated with the earth, the harvest, and so on. She says, natural springs are crucial sources of water for all life in the high desert. So the small spring near Aguate village, which is one of the villages of Laguna Pueblo, is literally the source and continuance of life for the people in the area. Interesting question, how many of us know where we live, what our water source is? Good, yeah. The spring also functions on a spiritual level, recalling the original emergence place and linking the people and the spring water to all other people and to that moment when the Pueblo people became aware of themselves as they are even now. The emergence was an emergence into a precise cultural identity. That's interesting. Again, emergence, this is a creation story that she's referring to. And the Pueblo mythology is the emergence place is 8 miles from the village where Silko was raised. And there is a ritual circuit, I'll read a little bit about that, that led from that place, from that emergence place into the village. And what she's recognizing is that this emergence really is a metaphorical narrative about an emergence into a cultural identity, into a knowledge of who we are as a people, rather than having to be understood literally. The 8 miles, marked with boulders, mesas, springs, and river crossings, are actually a ritual circuit or path that marks the interior journey of the that the Laguna people made. An interior journey. It was a journey of awareness and imagination in which they emerged from being within the earth and all included in the earth to the culture and people they became, differentiating themselves for the first time from all that had surrounded them. Thanks, Becca. Always aware that interior distances cannot be reckoned in physical miles or in calendar years. So this 8 mile circuit is a metaphorical journey. Obviously, there's a literal journey that you're walking, but that literal journey represents a journey into a self-awareness as a people. That's the idea. The narratives linked with prominent features of the landscape between Aguate and Laguna delineate the complexities of the relationship that human beings must maintain with the surrounding natural world if they hope to survive in this place. So that ritual journey was a reminder as they move through the mesas, the springs, the river crossings. It is a reminder of their interrelationship with that place, their dependence upon that place, certainly in terms of water, but also all that grows there, all that sustains life. Thus, she concludes, the journey was an interior process of the imagination, a growing awareness that being human is somehow different from all other life, animal, plant, and inanimate. Yet, we are all from the same source. And this is her final punchline. awareness never deteriorated into Cartesian duality, cutting off the human from the natural. So she is making a case, and I think she's trying to differentiate a certain idea of indigenous people as being so interlocked with place that there's no differentiation, essentially. And she's saying, no, of course there's differentiation. Of course. We know ourselves as a people. But what she's saying is that our awareness of ourselves as a people did not lead to what she calls Cartesian duality, where there is a very distinct separation from mind and that which lies elsewhere. So a very strong subject-object separation. Again, Descartes, at least the story that I know, and if some of you are philosophy professors, you can correct me, but the story that I know, Descartes literally, as he was working through foundational problems about reality, went to a room in Amsterdam, closed himself off in that room, in order to arrive at something absolute that he could name for certain. Here is one thing that I know exists that's real. And famously, what was his conclusion? Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Yeah, I think, therefore I am. That's the foundational block, if you want to put it that way, for Descartes. That's the one thing I can vouch for. Right. And Silko is trying to differentiate that position from this 8-mile circuit that these people walk, where there is a recognition that the individual self is intimately connected to what lies around. And if you're thinking about that walk, how many of you have walked the labyrinth out here at home or somewhere else?
Somewhere else.
I mean, if you've walked the labyrinth, you have some familiarity with something along the lines of what she's talking about, because the labyrinth, obviously, all it is, literally, is this pattern, a unicursal pattern. There's one way in that takes you to the center and one way out. It's not a maze in that sense. And so all you're doing is just walking around. And when you look at it, you may well think, well, this is kind of silly. I mean, what's the point of this? But in fact, clearly thousands of people, myself included, I did a week-long pilgrimage to Chartres. Part to walk the labyrinth at night, candlelit, or in chant. I mean, it was a profound experience. So that labyrinth really is a microcosm of a spiritual journey into a center, and that center is identified in some ways with Christ, or with Mary, or both. There's a six-petal rose in the middle of the labyrinth. It's very feminine, a very feminine image. So you arrive at that center, and then the idea is you are letting go. There is a kind of surrender, and then you walk back out again. So it is a ritual or ceremonial process. So it's not all that dissimilar. Or if during Easter week, Stations of the Cross, obviously another very good example, because there you are following the footsteps of Jesus, but you may be in your home church. It is an act of the imagination, moving more and more deeply into identification with Christ and all that Christ represents and all that the cross represents. And it's an interesting question. One reason that I like being part of a liturgical church is that I take these images seriously. I mean, and so it's another comparison would be the Eucharist. Is the Eucharist, is Holy Communion, simply a memorial of something that happened 2,100 years ago, more or less? Is it just in memory of a historical event that took place long ago? And for some people, the answer is yes. That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. For me, it's not just that. I mean, it is a living embodiment, an act that brings present in a very real way. And how you define that, of course, is tricky. I'm not a theologian, fortunately, so don't worry about that. But for me, there's a very real way in which that experience is right now. It is not just something Jesus did 2,100 years ago, and we say, thank you, Jesus. See, there's a little bit of evangelical coming up. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. By analogy, I think, this is the territory that Silco is walking us into. How many of you have not been here before? Okay. So, anybody want to summarize? We did this yesterday. Can you do that? Where have we been?
Started out in the hospital.
Okay.
In an iron bed.
Main character is sick. Teo. Not that much.
Shell shock from World War II.
Or trauma. Traumatized from World War II. Watched his half brother Rocky die. Felt guilt. Teo is himself a mixed blood Native American white. Never really accepted fully into the Native American community. Never accepted by his aunt, who has raised him after his mother died, which was another very important plot point. His mother died young. His mother had essentially prostituted herself and died very, very young. The one person that Teo was attached to was his uncle Josiah, who helped to take care of him. And you will remember, we talked about one scene where after the death of his mother, the funeral of his mother, Josiah gives the boy a candy cane, a leftover Christmas candy cane, and says,
Don't cry.
Okay. And the significance of that, stalwart class attendance.
It was leftover, it was useless, it was an afterthought, and that was his comfort at the death of his mother.
Yes.
And it wasn't part of his identity, the candy cane representing the Christian Christmas, and it wasn't who he was.
Yes. So if you think about the significance of Christmas as a ritual occasion, it was one of the high holy days of the church with profound significance. At least it's supposed to have. It is, of course, as we all know, spread out culturally and so on. But right at its heart, there's something very beautiful and very powerful about Christmas, even though it is not really rooted in a historical piece of information, right? Well, I don't remember in the Gospel of Mark it saying that Jesus was born on December 25th, the year zero. It doesn't say that. Christmas is right around the winter solstice, and so it obviously, we've been over this territory. It marks this transition from dark into light. It doesn't bother me, but then I'm a lit guy. It doesn't bother me that I don't have historical information that backs that birthday up. It speaks so profoundly symbolically of that experience in the Northern Hemisphere, of moving into that darkness. Anybody know what saint is celebrated on June 24th?
John the Baptist.
Very good. John the Baptist. Why John the Baptist?
Six months.
He must increase, I must decrease. John the Baptist. I remember because it's my wedding anniversary, which is a sort of odd day to get married in terms of the church calendar. I mean, John the Baptist and weddings, I don't think so. But it's beautiful symbolically, that balance. So, all Teo has to hold on to is a Christmas cane that has no ritual significance to it, no symbolic significance. The most it has is that it comes from Josiah, which has some significance, but it also says this is the most Josiah can offer him, which isn't very much, and then, stop crying. So that's a piece of the background. And so the essential storyline is Teo we're watching Teo move from a place of disconnection, fragmentation, isolation, and deep trauma, where he's at a point where he wouldn't speak and couldn't eat. He would vomit up anything that he would eat. He simply couldn't stomach anything. And the question is, how do we, now universalize it, how do we move from this place of brokenness into a place of healing? How does this occur? And in certain ways, everything that I teach, it just seems to come back to that same question. Because that is, in certain ways, our fundamental question.
Through ceremony.
Through ceremony. Well, that's the answer certainly the novel gives. Right?
And ritual.
Ceremony, ritual, those are clearly important.
Yes.
Yeah.
We heal through ceremony and ritual.
Mm-hmm. And does that ring true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also coming back to your true self, your true purpose.
You're right, okay. And how does that connect with ceremony and ritual? There's a question.
Well, he had to be led back to his true self by the bear.
Okay. So Teo goes through a ceremony, goes through a ritual, and that ritual in certain ways reconnects him with a larger story that is the Pueblo story, the emergent story, the creation story, but is also his story. So he is reoriented in some ways by that ceremony. And the ceremony has a number of different components to it. There is chant, there is some physical activity, there is the sand painting that he is placed in the middle of, and that sand painting symbolically is the landscape around him. So he is placed at the center of things in certain ways. And so he is, in a literal sense, reoriented to the land, and the land is connected to the stories. The stories are what, in part, give that land meaning. Otherwise, it's just land, as opposed to place. There are some scholars who talk about place as a human creation, in a certain sense. That is, place as having a bearing symbolic significance. So all of that is part of the process for Teo in terms of his healing. And again, it's always, the story is interesting, but my hope is too that the story can generate a certain amount of reflection about, okay, so what about my life? What about my story? What story do I connect to? How does this relate, especially if we're here at Holton in a Christian context? How does Christ's story? In what way do I inhabit it? Because that's what we're invited to do, ultimately. You want to follow me? How do you do it? Pick up your cross and follow me. So there is a movement into action, ultimately. And what happens for Teo is that he goes through a ceremony, and at the end of that ceremony, what we're told by the narrator is it wasn't finished. And so he then goes out, and part of the story is he has to gather up the spotted cattle that his uncle Josiah had brought. Josiah is now dead. And those cattle, in certain ways, represent part of himself as well. So he is gathering up these missing pieces.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that in the previous class that we took and on chain. And yeah. I was thinking about the fact that prior to him going to World War II, he promised his aunt that he would take care of Rocky, and Rocky died,
yes.
Which he had no control over.
Yes.
And he promised his uncle Josiah that he never would leave the ranch and help him take care of those spotted cattle. And then he went to war,
yes.
And his uncle died, which he had no control over. And
yes.
I think revisiting those two incidences in his life, as well as his mom's death,
mm-hmm.
which he had no control over, are important to the narrative in being in the middle of that sand and then beginning the journey of putting things in their place.
Yes, and that's what it is. Yeah, putting things in a sense back in their place. Recognizing that that place is always changing, and this is one of the things the story represents. The ceremonies continue to change, they continue to evolve, but they're always, you know, recognizing some kind of underlying pattern or way that is aligned with the truth, with beauty, and so on. There's this underlying sense of knowing when you are in the right place, so to speak. And I think we know that. I think if we're paying attention, we can experience within ourselves when we are aligned, if you want to use that metaphor. If you spent three nights drinking, rumor has it that some of my students do this. You know, you wake up and you can tell. You're just not really aligned.
Yeah.
And if that's going on for a long time, it gets to be, well, there's a very deep issue that needs to be dealt with. Does that happen?
I like the part where he was given the forgiveness about the ceremony, that the ceremony doesn't always have to be correct. It doesn't have to be the same way every time.
Yeah.
You're not making the rest of the world disturbed by
yeah.
doing it incorrectly. And that gave me some forgiveness in his own life. That,
that's right.
That even if he isn't correct in all he does, there's room to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a wonderful Jewish story that appropriately, perhaps, I won't remember exactly. About a rabbi a long time ago who had, this was handed down for generations, there was when the rabbi of his village had a profound question, they would go to the forest, they would take a particular set of beads, there would be hand gestures, there would be a chant, there would be a particular prayer, and then you would tell the story about what the need is. And then, you know, a few generations on, there's a rabbi who no longer has the beads, but, you know, I've got the chant, I've got the hand gestures, and here's the story. And there was always a sense that God has been listening. And then generations go by, and finally you reach a rabbi who doesn't have the beads, doesn't have the chant, doesn't have the hand gestures. He goes out to the forest and he says, you know, I don't have the old rich, I don't have anything here. All I've got is, here is my problem. Here is the problem of my village, of my community. And of course, God listened to him. And why did God listen to him? Because God likes stories. I mean, that's testament. God likes stories. The implication, of course, is that there's an element, all those things can be valuable and important, but you know, the core is that story, whatever is on your heart. All right. The handout begins on page 244 this time, I think. And the page before that I'm going to read, I see Jonathan sitting up here, so we're going to get to what you're after, I think. And if there is a piece of information, Jonathan, that feels appropriate about the development of the nuclear bomb, feel free to add details to this. One of the things, this novel, in a certain way, is all about synchronicity, all about patterns converging. And Holden is testimony to that sort of thing happening. And you can call it accident or coincidence. But Jonathan comes out here to talk about nuclear armaments and so on. It just so happens that this novel that I'm teaching ends right with that issue. So this is where we're going, the page right before your page.
That can you pass out another
one? Sure. Yeah, there are more, we do have some more copies. So if you don't have it, let's pass these around. And let's see, in the new edition, we are about 19 pages from the end. And there's a gap. And if, so you back up about 19 pages, you'll hit this paragraph. When years before they had first come to the people living on the Sevilleta land grant, they had not said what kind of mineral it was. And the they is unidentified. It's not identified in the text either. So there is a certain mystery about who these people are. They were driving U.S. government cars, and they paid the land grant association $5,000 not to ask questions about the test holes they were drilling. The cloudy orange sandstone mesas and the canyons between them were dry that year. Ever since the New Mexico territorial government took the northeast half of the grant, there had not been enough land to feed the cattle anyway. It was overgrazed. Rain eroded big arroyos in the gray clay, and the salt bush took hold. There was nothing there that people could use anyway, no silver or gold. The drought had killed off most of the cattle by then, so it didn't really matter if a square mile of land around the mine area was off limits. The high barbed wire fences around it, signs in Spanish and English warning them to keep out. Early in the spring of 1943, the mine began to flood with water from subterranean springs. They hauled in big pumps and compressors, and we're now on page 244, if you have the handout, on flatbed trucks from Albuquerque. The big trucks sank past their axles in the blow sand. They hired men from Bebo and Aquino to dig around the tandem wheel to attach tow chains from the trucks to the big tow truck that came. But later in the summer, the mine flooded again, and this time no pumps or compressors were sent. They had enough of what they needed, and the mine was closed. But the barbed wire fences and the guards remained until August 1945. By then, they had other sources of uranium. Interesting stylistically how she's doing this, sort of leading up little by little until you hit August 1945, and that date might resonate. And then finally, she names what we've perhaps been guessing. They had other sources of uranium, and it was not top secret anymore. Big gray vans came, hauled the machinery away. They left behind only the barbed wire fences, the watchman's shack, and the hole in the earth. Assimilated people salvaged lumber and tin from the shack, but had no use for the barbed wire anymore. The last bony cattle wandering the dry canyons had died in choking summer dust. So, there is a physical context for where this novel is culminating. At this point in the novel, Teo has successfully gathered up the cattle, and he has been spending most of his time out of the village, up in areas watching the cattle and so on. And there have been rumors spread about Teo, that there is something wrong with him still, that he's up there, he's hiding out, that he's gone crazy again, and he thinks that he's a Jap soldier or whatever. And these rumors have been spread by this peer of Teo's named Emo, that we talked about yesterday. Emo was also a vet of World War II, came back. And Emo is one of those individuals who collects human teeth, who loves to relive the stories of killing, and is still caught very much in that, and also with a tremendous amount of rage and self-hatred. The Native American soldiers, when they were in uniform, what they found was they were very popular. And the part of ceremony tells the story about Teo and the others being on the West Coast and being, in a sense, courted by young women, and so on. And so there was this brief period where they felt accepted, included, they had a community in the military. And of course, then the war ends, and all of that ends. And so this is Emo. And so Teo is, Emo has brought in some government people trying to hunt Teo down. But ultimately, Emo is also looking for Teo. And Teo no longer knows who to trust. He, on the one hand, he's reconnected in some ways with through the ceremony and through this figure that we talked about yesterday, Sei Montaña, a woman who in ways embodies that land. And so he is reconnected, but it's very fresh and new. And so there is also a lot of doubt, a lot of self-questioning, which again, I think is realistic. Any of us who've gone through some kind of important spiritual psychological process, we know that you may think, finally, all that's cleared out, and then 5 days later, you recognize that it's ongoing work, and all the doubts may arise very strongly. So this is where Teo is. He is up in the hills. As we hear, he is crawling through the strands of barbed wire. He's up there in this place where the uranium was taken, and on 245, if someone would read that paragraph beginning, Old Grandma.
Old Grandma told him while he was still sick and weak, lying
the darkened room. She shuffled in and sat down on the edge of his bed. "I've been thinking of something," she said. "It happened while you were gone. I had to get up, the way I do, to use the chamber pot." It was still dark. Everyone else was still sleeping. But as I walked back from the kitchen to my bed, there was a flash of light through the window. So big, so bright, even my old clouded up eyes could see it. It must have filled the whole southeast sky. I thought I was seeing the sunrise again, but it faded away, and by that time all the dogs around here were barking, like the time that bear was prowling around the trash pile. You remember that, Sonny, how they barked. My, my, I said to myself. I never thought I would see anything so bright again. She was patting his arm as she was talking, tapping out the story with her hand. Your auntie laughed at me when I told her what I saw. But later on that day, Romero came around. He said he saw it too, so bright that it blinded him for a moment. Then later on, he could still see it flashing when he closed his eyes. She paused as if she were trying to think of the right words. "You know, I have never understood that thing I saw. Later on, there was something about it in the newspaper. Strongest thing on this earth. Biggest explosion that ever happened. That's what the newspaper said." She was shaking her head slowly from side to side. "Now I only wonder why, grandson. Why did they make a thing like that?" "I don't know, Grandma," he had answered then. But now he knew.
So her comparison is, "I thought I was seeing the sunrise again." And those who've been following along will feel the resonance because this book essentially begins with that single word isolated on the page, sunrise. And at the beginning of the book, we may not have a full sense of why that is, but at the very end of the book, that's the word sunrise, followed by accept this offering, sunrise, finishes the book. And so we get a sense that we are within a ritual or ceremony, even as we're reading the book. The entire book is intended to be a ritual, going through this cycle. And it's not that it literally, clearly, it's not literally one day. But in some symbolic sense, we are moving within that ceremonial framework. And just as the novel for Teo, the main character, is moving towards a place of healing, a place of reconnection, which includes understanding, seeing the meaning in things, seeing the patterns, seeing, at least to an extent, why things have been this way. All that is part of the healing. And in contrast, of course, here, that sunrise is the bomb. So these are set in direct opposition or comparison with each other. And we'll come back to that. Somebody read the next paragraph. This whole section is just very rich.
He had been so close to it, caught up in it for so long, that its simplicity struck him deep inside his chest. Trinity Site, where they exploded the first atomic bomb, was only 300 miles to the southeast at White Sands. And the top secret laboratories where the bomb had been created were deep in the Jemez Mountains, is it pronounced Jemez?
Yeah, that sounds right.
On land the government took from Cochiti, Pueblo, Los Alamos, only 100 miles northeast of them now, still surrounded by high electric fences and the ponderosa pine and tawny sand rock of the Jemez Mountain Canyon, where the shrine of the Twin Mountain Lions had always been. There was no end to it. It knew no boundaries, and he had arrived at the point of convergence where the fate of all living things, and even the earth, had been laid. From the jungles of his dreaming, he recognized why the Japanese voices had merged with Laguna voices With Josiah's voice and Rocky's voice, the lines of cultures and worlds were drawn in flat, dark lines on fine, light sand, converging in the middle of witchery's final ceremonial sand painting. From that time on, human beings were one clan again, united by the fate the destroyers planned for all of them, for all living things, united by a circle of death that devoured people in cities 12,000 miles away, victims who had never known these mesas, who had never seen the delicate colors of the rocks which boiled up their slaughter.
And the rocks are yellow, and there is an association with the sunrise, and also we talked a little bit about yellow woman clutching an aqua, this appalling, a place of fertility, a place of new life, and so on. One of the things Silco says very explicitly is, it's not that the uranium inherently is bad or evil. Uranium is not evil. It's an element that is there. It's a question of to what use do you put things. It's always that question. So.
And these voices he's talking about, we're reflecting on here, are from his dream life, ever since he's returned from the Pacific.
Exactly.
From fighting Japanese.
Exactly. So.
That wasn't going to say anything. Is there
no, it looked
behind
like
me?
It looked like you. It looked
I
like
totally
you,
agree.
Yeah.
It just
yeah.
Makes sense.
Those of us who were here for the first day, the beginning of the novel, will remember that the very beginning again is Teo caught in a series of nightmares, and those nightmares are primarily a series of voices that he cannot untangle, he cannot make sense of. They're all just jumbled up in his mind. And the narrator draws a comparison to threads. It's like his grandmother's threads, these balls of yarn that as a boy he would kick over, they would get tangled up. And so one of the things the novel has been doing is untangling those threads, helping him to understand what in fact has been going on and how he personally is invested in it, engaged in it, in part responsible for it, but not just Teo. Clearly, it is universal at this point. So in an ironic way, the atomic bomb has united all people.
Human beings are one clan again.
One clan again. Human beings are one clan again. And for Teo, of course, in this story, what he now realizes is that this uranium that was then transformed, and then whether literally, and Jonathan, I don't know if it's actually that uranium and so on, but symbolically, of course, there he is over fighting the Japanese and identifying Uncle Josiah with the Japanese. This is part of Teo's breakdown. He could not face-to-face kill that Japanese soldier as he was told to do because he saw his uncle's face in that soldier. In spite of Rocky and everybody else saying to him, Teo, it's just a Jap soldier. It's not your uncle, literally. Of course, that's true. But on a deeper level, Teo was glimpsing something that was true, that soldier is related to Teo, as we are all related. And so now, coming back home, arriving at this site, pieces are fitting together, finally. And Trinity site, we alluded to this yesterday. The only thing about Trinity site, Jonathan, is this your territory at all?
Not in great depth,
okay.
Except obviously it's the place they tested, and what's striking was only weeks before they went and used them. I think it was within 2 months.
Yeah, that was my sense.
They were so sure
it
would work and it worked, and then they went ahead and did it.
Yeah.
Did it twice.
Do we know, Jonathan, how it got that name?
No.
Why it was called Trinity?
Yeah.
I think God was trying to tell us something.
Yeah, and of course this is part of the irony of this particular location. And think about the nature of the Trinity theologically. at least my understanding, which is not a theologian's, but my understanding is there's this beautiful word perichoresis to talk about sort of the dance of the Trinity. The Trinity represents a way of understanding ultimate reality as being in relationship, fundamentally. Ultimate reality is about relationship, Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
Luther used to write that all believers are theologians.
Okay, good. So I can pontificate.
As a theologian.
Some are lay and some are not, but
all right.
We're all theologians.
All right. That's good. So I'm on safe.
If we think about God at all,
if
we're
we
theologians.
Think about God, we're
yeah.
Theologians. Yeah. But that's just it's you know, what I'm trying to bring out, of course, is that a Trinitarian concept really is a faith that fundamentally we are created in relationship, for relationship, out of relationship, and that relationship and that exchange that we do in relationship, that gift giving, that Eucharist, which is a thanksgiving, really is an echo or manifestation of underlying reality. This is what truth looks like. And what we have here, of course, is an inversion of that, yeah.
I was just going to add from yesterday that Trinity also has room for the wisdom tradition that you talked about with the mountains. And the,
yes. Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is rich and adds breadth inclusivity. In that.
All things created out of this wisdom. And this is the nature of wisdom in a fullest sense. Wisdom is not just a matter of facts and book learning. And I'm putting my hand up because there's light right behind you. I'm trying to see it better. Yeah, absolutely. This is wisdom is a particular way of knowing things. And so what we have here is clearly a perversion, an inversion of that genuine Trinity. And so at the core of the atom bomb, the creation of the atom bomb is dependent upon what ability? What do you have to do?
Break it all apart. Break
and the it being? Adam. Yeah. Okay. So this
the
is
ultimate. Huh? The ultimate.
Yeah. I mean, atoms were thought of as the ultimate element, so to speak. Right? That which could not be divided. Again, symbolically. And so what Silko is suggesting is that this action is a culmination of a way of thinking, a way of being in relationship or out of relationship with the natural world. That is a development of analysis, a development of a clear sense of separation and power over the natural world, a mastery of the natural world. And you know, you can read this clearly in Francis Bacon, so many thinkers. That this is the understanding. That we have the right, we have sovereignty, and so on. And so
we can split the atom.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, what we've been doing is the process of analysis is by definition a means of separating things off, separating things into their parts. And as I said yesterday and the day before, it's a very powerful tool. I teach in college, I teach at a university. I mean, clearly, you know, a primary tool that I use is analysis. But I'm always, and one of the reasons I like teaching at a Christian university is I feel like I can simultaneously try to teach this skill and use texts that draw attention to the possible problems with that skill if it is taken to be the ultimate way to reality. How do we most fully get to know the truth? And one answer would be, well, you keep splitting and splitting and splitting. And finally, you're going to arrive. And what we arrived at was the splitting of the atom, which unleashes, literally, a tremendous power. A tremendous power. And Silko is taking this symbolically as a kind of culmination. And the explosion, that sense of it is an alternate sunrise, it is as if that moment of the creation of the bomb was a godlike act.
A new creation.
A new creation, precisely. A new creation. But what kind of creation is it?
One that destroys.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not a creation that gives life, but gives death.
That gives death.
That one of the things that's, I think, very relevant, every nuclear power tested their bombs in the oldest cultures that they had power over.
Yes.
They're always in the lands of indigenous people.
Yes.
We did it in the Pacific Islands as well as in the American West.
Bikini. Yeah.
The Russians did it in Central Asia.
Yeah.
The Chinese did it in Central Asia. The French did it in Algeria, in the desert, and in the Polynesia. The British did it in the middle of Australia on Christmas Island. And every time it's the most so-called advanced choosing to do their experiment. And it strikes me too, it raises the issue of what's the definition, what makes places holy?
Right.
Isn't every place holy probably to somebody?
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're not able to recognize even the holy ones to us sometimes.
Yes. And Silko alludes to a shrine that's there in the land. The land holds the stories. That's one of the ways in which they are made holy. And we've discussed a little bit that question. And it's a good question for a week-long class, of course. And a lot more than that. But this is what Teo is now putting together in some ways. He is now understanding there is a culmination of a kind of story that Silko refers to as witchery. Right? And witchery is taking the elements of the earth and using them essentially for one's own benefit or so on. It is the opposition. You know, we would just call it evil or sin. It is that opposition. And Teo is finding himself there in a certain sense at ground zero. So putting the pieces together. The pattern of the ceremony was completed there, as he says in that next paragraph, 246. He found the ore rock, the gray stone was streaked with powdery yellow uranium, bright and alive as pollen, and so on and so forth. Well, they had taken these beautiful rocks from deep within earth, and they had laid them in a monstrous design, realizing destruction on a scale only they could endure. And Teo cries with relief at seeing the pattern, how the stories fit together. So he is making sense of it. What happens at this point? I'm aware of the time. What happens at this point, and the rest of your handout, we skip a few pages. Teo comes to the realization that his so-called buddies, Emo in particular, are out looking for him, and they're not looking for him because they're worried about him. They're looking for him because they want to make Teo a sacrifice. This is Emo. And we're also told we're right at the time as the book is ending at the autumn solstice. So there is a turning point, again, of light and dark being at a midpoint. And Emo, again, one of the interesting things is Silko is not saying it's all the white people's fault. She can be pretty severe on Western philosophy. But Emo is a full-blood Laguna Pueblo Indian. And Emo is the primary one who is doing local destruction. He is really aligned with this rage and this hatred. And he literally wants to make Teo a sacrifice. And when he can't find Teo, he takes Harley, who allowed Teo to escape at one point. And in the pages where the handouts pick up, we find that what they're doing is torturing Harley. I think you pick up at 252, perhaps?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Teo is forced to watch this occur. And I alluded yesterday to a decision that Teo had to make, and we're right at that place now. And it's a really huge question. Teo is a matter of yards away from where this is taking place. And Emo, believing that Teo may be within hearing, taunts Teo as they're literally torching Harley. About a paragraph down or so on 252. Look at this, you half-breed white son of a bitch. You can't hide from this. Look, your buddy Harley. Aren't you going to do something about this? Aren't you going to come rescue him? And it goes on from there. Skip a few paragraphs. middle of that paragraph, about halfway down the page, Teo has a screwdriver that he picked up, and it's gripped now tightly in his hand. He understood that Harley had bargained for it. He realized Harley knew how it would end if he failed to get the victim he had named. But Teo could not endure it any longer. He was certain his own sanity would be destroyed if he did not stop them, and all the suffering and dying they caused. The people incinerated and exploded, the little children sleep on streets, outside gallop bars. He was not strong enough to stand by and watch. He would rather die himself. And what Silver does here, of course, is to expand it from a particular situation. That particular situation really embodies all that Teo knows and experiences about what's happening to people and his people every day. Every day. And if you sit with that feeling, where does it lead you? It's so difficult not to spend your life in a state of rage and wanting somebody to strike back at. And that's Emo's, that's been Emo's choice. And it's understandable. That's where Teo is sitting right here. How do you not strike back? Bottom of the page, you visualize the contours of Emo's skull. The GI haircut exposed, thin bone of the temples. She's very precise about this. Top of the next page. You fucking little queer. Leroy kicks sand in his face and Pinky lunges at him. This novel is back 1977. And I always have been struck by this moment in the novel.
It's what did you say?
It was published in 1977.
Oh.
And that Silco would pick up that one of the ultimate outcasts would be a member, you know, a gay person.
A gay person.
And in particular, and Silco talks about this in her essay, that within the Pueblo tradition, there was no stigma attached to it. There were always going to be, there were certain men who would dress up in women's clothes and so on. And there was a place within the community for them. And so this is clearly an example, as is the language itself, of Emo embodying not the traditional culture. So Teo, you continue through 253. Teo stayed on his knees right before the break point there. Leroy had a knee on Pinky's throat. You could hear raspy choking sounds. Emo was laughing loudly, pointing at the body hanging stiffly. And I think we've got 5 minutes.
Oh, keep going,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. He could hear raspy, this is not a good place to end, for sure.
No.
Emo was laughing loudly, pointing at the body hanging stiffly, swaying a little in the gusts of wind, and pointing at Leroy, kneeling on Pinky's throat. Did somebody pick up at that point at the break point with the moon was lost in a cloud bank?
The moon was lost in a cloud bank. He moved it towards boulders that had been a close call. The witchery had almost ended the story according to its plan. Teo had almost jammed the screwdriver into Emo's skull the way the witchery had wanted, savoring the yielding bone and the membrane as the steel ruptured the brain. Their deadly ritual for the autumn solstice would have been completed by him. He had been another victim, a drunk Indian war veteran settling an old feud. The army doctors would say that the indications of this had been there all along since his release from the mental ward at the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles. The white people would shake their heads, more proud than sad that it took a white man to survive in their world and that these Indians couldn't seem to make it. At home, the people would blame liquor, the army, the war, but the blame on the whites would never match the vehemence the people would keep in their own bellies, reserving the greatest bitterness and blame for themselves, for one of themselves they could not save.
Okay, so turn over to 254. And what we discover is that Harley has died. They put the body into the trunk of their car, and they drive off. And if someone would pick up there at the breakpoint on 254, we would go back there now.
Yeah. He would go back there now, where she had shown him the plant. He would gather the seeds for her and plant them with great care in places near the sandy hills.
And to pause you, that the she is Saint Montagne, this woman, sort of supernatural figure with whom he had his relationship.
The rainwater would seep down gently, and the delicate membranes would not be crushed or broken before the emergence of tiny fingers, roots and leaves pressing out in all directions. The plants would grow there like a story, strong and translucent as the stars. His body was lost in exhaustion. He kept moving, his bones and skin staggering behind him. He dreamed with his eyes open that he was wrapped in a blanket in the back of Josiah's wagon, crossing the sandy flat before Paguet Hill. The chola and the juniper shivered in the wind, and the rumps of the two gray mules were twin mules in front of him. Josiah was driving the wagon. Old Grandma was holding him, and Rocky whispered, "My brother, they are taking him home."
And if someone would continue, we'll do two more paragraphs.
The creosote and tar smell of the railroad tracks woke him from the dreaming. The cinders made hollow crunching noises under his boots. He had come a long way with them, but it was his own 2 feet that caught him there. He stepped high over the steel rails and went down the cinder bank roadbed toward the river. When he felt the dampness of the river, he started running. The sun was pushing against the gray horizon hills, sending yellow light across the clouds, and the yellow river sand was speckled with the broken shadows of tamarack and river willow. The transition was completed. In the west and in the south too, the clouds with round, heavy bellies had gathered for the dawn. It was not necessary, but it was right. And even if the sky had been cloudless, the end was the same. The ear for the story and the eye for the pattern were theirs. The feeling was theirs. We came out of this land, and we are hers. In the distance, he could hear big diesel trucks rumbling down Highway 66 past Laguna. The leaves of the big cottonwood tree had turned pale yellow. The first sunlight caught the tips of the leaves at the top of the old tree and made them bright gold. They had always been loved. He thought of her then. She had always loved him, and she had never left him, and she had always been there. He crossed the river at sunrise.
So Silko sets this contrast between, again, one kind of ceremony that was witnessed and created where he is located. And he creates an alternate ceremony under the guidance of Saint Montagne, who is, again, a kind of embodiment of that land, that place, those stories, the understanding that that place is a living place, that we are in relationship with it. And so what he does is he goes and he finds the plants, the seeds that she had shown him. And of course, those seeds are the affirmation of life continuing. It is a very, very small act. In comparison, and that's what's so striking, I mean, splitting an atom, which is this tiny, tiny thing, and releasing this tremendous amount of energy, is set against the tiny act of gathering seeds and planting them. And that latter act can seem insignificant in the face of that destructive power. But Silko is saying, this is what we must do on a daily basis. We must gather the seeds and plant them. They would grow there like the story, strong and translucent as the stars. And so those stars indicate a greater energy still in some ways that is aligned with those plants. And at the very end, again, the contrast between, he's in the modern world. There's Highway 66. Highway 66 is one of the archetypal roads in America, crossing that southern part of the country. We all know the song, probably. Get your kicks on Route 66. Yeah. So there he is. There he is. And then set against that, the leaves of the cottonwood tree turning yellow, and just the lyrical quality of the prose, I think, gives us that feeling of what it feels like to be in that environment as opposed to along Route 66. And ultimately, it is that experience of the cottonwood, the sunlight, and of course that returns us to our beginning and our end, and that ultimate statement, they had always been loved. He thought of her, she had always loved him. And to whom is he referring? The she, the pronoun.
The earth.
The earth, absolutely. That's one correct answer.
But there are other very important women in his grandmother.
Yes.
His mother.
Yes.
Perhaps the black.
The night swan. Night swan. Sure. Say Montagna, most immediately. All of those figures. So he is reclaiming, rediscovering the missing moment. So another way of saying at the core of the story is a recovery of that missing mother. That missing, and all that that mother represents. And certainly the land is part of that traditionally, along with his personal story. So the personal story is also really a universal story for all of us, is regaining that connection, that sense of we have always been loved. We have always been loved. And that's the novel really ends really on that note. He crossed the river at sunrise. It's really quite lovely. And we get a few more pages, and at the very end we find out that some of the other friends of Teo's have died. Emo has killed one of them, and they call it an accident, and they send him to California. You can never come back to the Pueblo. And Teo says, yeah, California, that's a good place for Emo. And the grandmother, at the very end, just says, I must be getting old. It seems like I already heard these stories before. Only thing is, the names sound different. And what Silke was saying is, of course, right? I mean, these are the same stories of, this is Adam and Eve, whatever story you want to think of, that we are also living in our lifetimes, trying to find those patterns, that sense of meaning, that sense of place, and so on. Just like Taylor. Just about made it. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.